Okay, good evening. I made a slight change in plans, and the slight change in plans is like this. I was planning on giving the same class this morning as the class tonight, figuring I'd get through quite a bit of that Gada, and there'll be a lot of material. After an hour and a quarter this morning, I see I didn't get very far. So what I've decided to do is I'm making this morning's class part one. And this class, well, here, is part two. It's just going on in the Haggadah. So what happens is, I mean, I could have gone just repeated part one, but then there'd only be the one thing online for people to look at. So now that I've done part two, I'm doing part two now, you can listen online to part one. One has nothing to do with the other, so that, you know, you can hear one without the other. This way will be twice as much material on the website. So, and you'll have from this Tuesday, I won't have class next Tuesday. So you could just, next Tuesday, just listen online to part one. So that's, so you'll have 2 hours worth of content, 2.5 hours worth of content for your Haggadah, which should be helpful. So I figured that would work out better. Either way, you'd only hear an hour and a quarter at this sitting. So, but this way, more, I know there's a lot of people who listen online, so they'd be able to hear two classes. So that's the idea. So if you say, why are we starting in the middle of the Haggadah? It's because we're starting where I left off this morning. So we're going to start with, we're at Manishtano Halayla, on page 8. On page 8. That's all I got up to. I didn't say to me. I may not finish what I have here either. I may not even finish what I have here, what I prepared. I don't know. We'll see. Who said? That's right. Okay. Anyway, so the first thing is not in your Haggadah, but there are in certain Haggadahs. Before it comes to the words Manishtana, it writes in small print. It says, "Vekan haben shoel," and here the child asks, and then they come to Manishtan. So they tell a story that happened at the Seder of the Tiferet Shlomo, Rav Shlomo of Radomsk, one of the great Hasidic rabbis. And the story was, there was a young a married fellow who didn't have any children, and he was spending Seder at the Rebbe's table. And he heard from the Rebbe that this is a very auspicious time, the Seder night, is to ask for children. And he says, and you can see that it's an important time, a great time to ask for children, because it says in the Haggadah, Vekan haben shoel. Vekan, and now, at this time, haben shoel, you can ask for a child. You can ask for a child. It's a good time. It's a great time of spiritual energies coming down. And therefore, he could ask for a child. And he took advantage of that situation. And the next year, he had a child. So that's, if you can tell anybody who needs some children, that might be a good thing to do. Other Sfarim bring as well that, in general, Pesach is an auspicious time for children and for good children, as it were. And to ask from Hashem that you should have, as we see shortly, Banim Lamokom, children to the Almighty. And similarly, we could say another aspect. It could be that Kan Haben Shoel means really, the truth of the matter is, we are all children of Hashem. And really, this night, we could ask Hashem for anything we want. In other words, it's such a holy time, and many of us are stuck in all kinds of places and having all kinds of challenges. And you can ask from Hashem whatever you need, and to get life from that, from everything that's transpiring at the Seder, and to reach for things that you wouldn't normally be able to reach. Okay, so that's, and it does, you don't have to be a great person. You're a Ben, a son, no, nobody, you don't have to be a big rabbi or anybody. It's a very auspicious time for that to happen. Okay, now, the next idea I want to, it's going to be a lot of short 5-minute jumps, whatever, and some a little longer, but. Now, in the man, we say Manishtana, what makes this night different than all the other nights? There's a tremendous amount of holiness enveloping the universe at this time. And it's an interesting custom that one of the great rabbis, the Maharil, had a custom. And the commentators explain an interesting reality to this custom. It says in the Shulchan Aruch that you should adorn your table with all kinds of fineries, good utensils, expensive silver, all these things you should, even though we're not ostentatious a whole year, but the Seder we adorn with this. And it says the Maharil, an early rabbi, he normally would not make, Maharil was a very wealthy rabbi, unusual, and he would lend money to non-Jews and get interest for it. But of course he would take collaterals from them. And they would give him all kinds of china and very, you know, nice types of things as collaterals. Now, of course, he never would use them. First of all, they weren't kosher, eh? He'd make no use of them, except on the night of Pesach. And on the night of Pesach, what did he do? He would put it all out on the table, all the collaterals that he had. He put on the table, he wasn't going to use them, but he would enjoy looking at them, as it were, to show, we're all supposed to show that we're regal and royal and free and all this, to show that. Now, certainly he wasn't going to use any of those utensils, because they were trade utensils. But he would use them insofar as adorning the table. So, it's interesting, there is an interesting halacha in Jewish law, that obviously any utensil that a non-Jew cooks any tray food in, you certainly can't eat it. But we know there's another halacha. So let's say a non-Jew buys the utensil, but he never uses it. Okay, now a Jew buys it from him. Is the Jew allowed to use it straight away? The answer is no. What do you got to do? You got to take it to the mikveh. And the question is, why do you got to take it to the mikveh? In other words, why do you got to take it to the mikveh? Just because he owned it, he didn't use anything treif with it. The Chasam Sofer, in one of his drushes, he says that when a non-Jew just thinks about having a utensil and thinks of what he's going to use it for. Now, in general, a non-Jew looks at the world in a narcissistic way. And he's going to look at, how is that going to give me pleasure? But he doesn't want to uplift it in any kind of a spiritual way. He says that itself, the ownership of it, brings a certain tuma, brings a certain impurity to that utensil. And they write that it's a great danger for a Jew to use such a utensil. And therefore we take it to the mikveh to uplift it from its low spiritual level. In spite of the negative aspect of benefiting from a non-Jewish utensil, still we see that the Maharil, he would benefit from these utensils on Pesach, even though he didn't take it to the mikveh. And how could he do that? And the answer is because it was the power of the night. The power of Pesach can transform everything, not just people. The energy of redemption can redeem an inanimate object. Just as we see Hashem was able to control the whole inanimate object of in the world of in Egypt with all the plagues. So therefore, the tumah for that night, the impurity, the grasp that the secular world has, that tumah is broken. And the Jew can break away from that himself. And we talked a lot about that in part one of the class. And it applies not only to him, but it'll apply to any utensils that he has will not have that kind of impurity. Okay, let's move on now to some more standardized Dvar Torahs. And let us go to, I just got to make sure I got all my things over here. Oh, I have a lot, and I put little markers all over the place. I just want to skip anything here. We did this. Okay. Yes, very good. So let's go to, call Marvelous Saper, page 9. Avodim Hayinu. So the answer to the four questions is that we're slaves in Egypt, and Hashem took us out there with a strong arm, strong hand, an outstretched arm, and if Hashem wouldn't have taken us out, we'd still be there, etc., etc. And even if we were all intelligent people and wise men, and we know the whole Torah, mitzvah leinu lesaper b'yisrael, so it's a mitzvah for us to discuss the exodus of Egypt, no matter how scholarly we are. V'chol amar b'lesaper b'yisrael mitzrayim, and the more that a person speaks about the exodus of Egypt, Harei ze mishubach. So what does harei ze mishubach literally means? Harei ze, behold, this is praiseworthy. Now, It's interesting. It doesn't end by saying the more you speak about it, Hareze asa mitzvah, you did a big mitzvah. It says, Hareze mishubach, as if it's defining the person. And what the Seder is saying is that the more you talk about the Exodus on the Seder night, the more you do, that tells us that you are a more praiseworthy person. Hareze. Zed, this person, called Amar Belzaba, the one who speaks more, Harei Zed, this person himself, Mishubach, is a more praiseworthy person. So what does that mean? So the rabbis give a beautiful analogy. And this you could tell at any table. This word is could tell to anybody. Secular, religious, everyone's got to like this one. You have a prince, young fellow, and unfortunately, he's taken captive, taken to a strange country. He's treated like a slave. He's denigrated, like all slaves are. He's there for many, many years, and it's really been terrible, and there's no way he could ever have left. Anyway, finally, after many years, he has the opportunity to escape. And he escapes, but when he was taken captive, he was a very young child. And now many years have passed, and frankly, people couldn't quite recognize if it was the child or not. You know, long hair, and over years, you change looks a lot. Well, he wasn't the only guy who was taken captive. There were other people taken captive. And the prince, he escaped with some other people. He happened to escape with another guy in particular. Same age, same around build, different looking person, but he says, boy, I'm so happy to leave because I'm the prince. When I'm going to go to my daddy and tell him who I am, you know, I'm going to be sitting on the throne. The guy says, how old were you when you were taken? Oh, about 3 years old, you know, 4 years old. He's old enough to know he was a prince, but I think this is a great opportunity. He says, do you mind if I tag along with you? He says, sure, keep coming until I get to the palace, you know. I'll tell him you're my friend. Finally, after a long, arduous journey, they make it to the palace. And before the prince can say anything, the other guy comes running into the palace and says, I'm here! I'm the prince! I'm back! And the prince was like, what are you talking about? He said, no, it's me! Me, you, me, back and forth! How long ago were you captured? So he gives the date. He says, yeah, that's the date. Sounds good. And the king comes. He can't tell the difference. You know, they're all disheveled. And, you know, after many years, you can always recognize your own kid. Don't know what to do. There's no way to figure it out. So one of the big generals says, you know, let me handle it, Your Majesty. I'll come to the bottom line of this. So he calls in the first fellow. He calls him in privately. So let me ask you some questions. Tell me what happened while you were in this exile. Tell me everything that happened and how you felt. So he starts saying, oh, it was terrible. They hit me, they beat me, they starved me, they enslaved me, they gave me hard work to do day and night. It was terrible. It was terrible. And what else do you want to tell me? Don't hide anything back from me. He says, listen, could it be anything worse than that? Starved me. Beat me, crushed me. It was like living in a Holocaust. What else is there to say? Okay, thank you. You go. Calls the next fellow. He says, no, tell me what happened with you. So he starts to say the same thing. They hit me, they beat me, they this and that. He says, anything else you want to tell me? He says, you know, well, the worst part was, and I figured, look what kind of bread they were giving me. Coarse bread. Unrefined bread. You know, I was used to much finer kinds of breads in life. You know. And going with a garment, a dirty garment, for like a month on end without it ever getting washed. That was terrible. How I had to sleep on a hard ground when I'm used to being on a comfortable bed. You know what the worst thing was of all? They wouldn't let me read any books so I could expand my mind to rest up a little bit. And And to be with all these uneducated people, uncouth people, that was probably the worst thing of all. The general said to the king, "That's the prince. That's the prince." Because it's not just the present conditions that was making him feel bad, but it was in comparison to what it was like beforehand. And that's what the master of the Haggadah is telling us over here. Kol hamarva l'saper, the more you can speak, the more you have to say, then that shows you that when you're going to talk about it from different angles, not just about the suffering that the Jews went through, but you talk about the spiritual decline and the spiritual suffering that happened, that shows that you're a more praiseworthy person. You understand? Because there's ways of looking at things superficially that any Tom, Dick, and Harry could say this was an amazing thing we got out of this. But the depth and how much more there is to say, because you know there is so much more that we lost and there's so much more we regained afterwards, that shows you that you are this prince. And a person doesn't have a lot to say, says, okay, yeah, God took us out of Egypt. That's every year we remember God took us out of Egypt and the slavery and the this and that. But if you don't have more to say, that shows you yourself are not a prince. And really, we have to look at, all of us have to feel like princes. And the only way you can feel like a prince is to really go into detail how much it's so much better that now that we're free. You ask a secular Jew, like, what's so amazing? I say, well, it was a nation got of oppression. So how are you different than the blacks who were freed from slavery? They're going to say, no different. No different. Well, it's not a very praiseworthy person. You say, how? They ask a person who's more spiritually inclined. He says, what do you mean, what's the difference? Now we could learn Torah. Now we could do so many things that we couldn't do before. Now we could be a light unto nations. Now we could do all these things. So the more you talk about it, hareza meshubach, the more praiseworthy you are. Okay. Then after that, we have a story. A story that seems to very simply follow to prove this point. A story with Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, on the bottom of page 9, coming up to 10, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon. They were having a Seder in Bnei Brak. They were discussing the Exodus the whole night until their students came and said, Rebbe's, it's time for the morning Kriya Shema. So the simple meaning of this paragraph following, what is a classic example. We just said, even if you're a great scholar, the more you talk about it, the more praiseworthy you are. So here's a good example of it. We have the five of the greatest scholars in the generation. They knew everything, and they still had what to say the whole day. So that shows you that no matter how smart, that's the simple interpretation. However, the rabbis ask, listen, don't you think there were a lot of rabbis at the Talmud that did this? Were these the only five rabbis at the Talmud who did this? What about Abaye and Rava? There's tons of rabbis in the Talmud. Why did the Torah, why did the author of the Haggadah pick these five rabbis more than anyone else? And there's no shortage of rabbis in the Talmud. And yes, it was during the Roman oppression and all that, but there were plenty of rabbis having seders during the Roman oppression. And we could have picked any other random story of another seven rabbis learning in Yerushalayim and four rabbis learning over there in Tzvat, Techves. So what's so much about these rabbis? So Rabbi Asher, Zichron Levracha, says there's an amazing lesson you can learn from this. One of the greatest messages of the Pesach story is to realize that the Jews are on the 49th level of impurity. Before they left Egypt, they couldn't have been any lower than the low. They are right at the brink. One step more, they would not have been able to be saved in their negative spiritual state that they were at. If they would have waited one more second, they would not have been able to come out. And yet, they were redeemed. And they were able to be the people that 7 weeks later were able to receive the Torah. Unbelievable. Now, you would think that such a low group of people really should have been in despair and given up hope. And yet, Hashem did not give up hope on them. And something came out of them. And we have to look at the same thing. There's certainly a lot of people, we see many Jews today, maybe we feel about ourselves sometimes, who feel they're on one of the lowest levels of impurity too. They probably give up of any hope. This guy's a Russia. There's no hope. Why should we even bother with this fellow? But you see that Hashem saved the Jews who were not very great people either. And you see that it can happen. So the question is, where do we find this amazing strength to turn a person around, that they could change from one extreme to the other? And says the author of the Haggadah, let's look at this particular story with these five rabbis. Now with these five rabbis, you see the greatest demonstration of this. So let's take a brief look at these five rabbis. The first rabbi was Reb Eliezer. Reb Eliezer is better known as Reb Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Reb Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, to the best of my understanding of the Midrashim, suffers great learning disabilities. Although in those times, more didn't mention, have the term learning disabilities. But his father was a wealthy man, Hyrcanus, and he had all his boys work on the farms. And some of the boys went to yeshiva a little bit. But Eliezer was 28 years old and didn't know anything. Why? Because he was not so bright. Plain and simple, wasn't it? And he had always begged his father, he wants to learn Torah. And Pharaoh says, you know, you're a strong guy. You work on the farm with your other brothers, and one day you're going to have this farm, and, you know, you'll give tzedakah, you'll be a good Jew. You don't have to be a scholar. He said, but I want to learn Torah. So what does he do at 28 years old? He picks himself up, and he goes to Yerushalayim. He goes to the famous yeshiva of Yochanan ben Zakkai. You know, that's like imagining if say, a 28-year-old today, you know, totally ignorant, wants to go to the Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim and go to Rav Asher Eliezer's shir, where there's over 1,000 guys go to that shir, the most complex Gemara. It's probably one of the most sophisticated classes in the world. He wants to go there. Okay? And he went. And as you go, if you look through the entire story, the way it's mentioned in Pirkei the Rav Nosson, Avos Rav Nosson, like every time he comes to Rav Yochanan Zakkai, he says, no, you want to come to our yeshiva? Very nice. Tell me, what Gemara are you learning? He says, I'm sorry, Holy Rabbi, I don't know any Gemara. So tell me, do you know any Mishnayos? He says, Holy Rabbi, I don't know any Mishnayos. Do you know any Chumash? I don't know any Chumash. Do you know Aleph Beis? No. He says, well, I don't know if we can keep you in this yeshiva. It's like for scholars. And then the Gemara says, so at this 20-year-old, he starts crying. He starts crying like a baby. He says, I want to learn Torah. I want to learn Torah. Anyway, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, okay, repeat after me. Shema, Shema, Yisrael, Hashem, Elokeinu, Hashem, Echad. So that's your first lesson. Review that. Come tomorrow. We'll give you another lesson. And then he would give them to different people in the yeshiva to spend a few minutes with him. Well, anyway, he stayed in the yeshiva. The father was so upset that he went to yeshiva. He was wealthy. So for a while he was giving him a little bit of money, because after all, he's his son. But his friends convinced him to stop giving the money and then he'll come back. He stopped giving the money, and as time passed, he had no food to eat. And then one day, Rav Yochanan Zakkai notices that the student doesn't look so. He says, is everything okay? He says, yeah, thank God it's okay. He says, when was the last time you had a square meal? He starts crying again. He says, come, you're going to live in my house. Anyway, he stays many, many years in that yeshiva. Finally, one day, his father, Hyrcanus, who said, I've cut him out. So he says, and after another, he says, this is crazy. He's been there so many years already. This can't happen anymore. I'm going to go to Yerushalayim. I'm going to bring him home once and for all. I know he's in some yeshiva in Yerushalayim. There can't be that many yeshivas in Yerushalayim. Certainly there are less then than there are now. So he goes along, and he finally bumps into Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, maybe you could help me. I'm looking for my son. Yes, who's your son? His name is Eliezer. It's Eliezer. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm very busy right now, but you know, there's a very big scholar who's giving a class to the whole yeshiva now, and we're going to make a big party at the end because he's giving his first class. You know what, maybe just sit in on the class a little bit, And then afterwards I'll talk to you, because right, I'm a little bit busy. So he sits down in the back, and there's this rabbi with a beard, and he's up there, and he's momish like a scholar. He's giving a first-rate class from Talmud all over the place, and everyone's asking him questions, and he's answering questions. It's unbelievable. And then in the middle of the class, or towards the end of the class, Hyrcanus realizes, he says, "Is that my son?" And now he comes after the class, and they're all singing, and they're escorting him out with all this honor and this and that. And then the father and son cry together. And then the father says, "You know what? I'm going to disown my other sons and give you all the money." Anyway, so what do you see? What do you see from this? That Rebbe Eliezer was not exactly destined for greatness. But you could see that what did he become? One of the greatest rabbis of the generation. He's one of the people at the Seder. Then we have Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon, the Talmud tells us that he was incredibly wealthy. He owned so many assets. It was like a magnate. And generally speaking, the wealthy people don't have a lot of time to learn Torah. The wealthier they are generally, the more ignorant they are. And in spite of all the wealth he had, he said, "That's not important to me. I got to focus on learning Torah." And he became a great, great leader of the generation in Torah. Again, an unlikely source for Torah greatness. Rabbi Shua ben Hanania. On the other hand, the Gemara tells us elaborate stories about his abject poverty. He was so poor, all the walls in his house were black, because he was a blacksmith, which was not a very profitable job in those days. And the poverty was so, so terrible. And with all that poverty, usually when you're poor, you're not going to grow up to be a great rabbi either. And he became one of the great leaders of the generation. Rabbi Akiva, what can we say about Rabbi Akiva? Rabbi Akiva, until he was 40 years old, he didn't learn one word of Torah. He was an ignoramus, and more than ignoramus, he hated Torah scholars. And he said, before I changed my life, if I see a Torah scholar, I'd kick him like a mule. That's how much anger he had towards Torah scholars. But a woman named Rachel noticed his greatness and said, "You know what, if you will learn Torah, I will marry you. And much to the chagrin of her father, who was a wealthy man, who disowned her because of that. And she says, "Listen, go learn Torah, go to school." He says, "I'm ashamed to go, so I'm going to sit in pre-1A, learning Aleph Beis with all the kids. You know what kind of embarrassment that's going to be?" So he had a very clever wife. You know what she did? Says, "Do me a favor. Take a donkey, and I want you to put a lot of sand on the back of the donkey. And pat it in really good so it's secure on the donkey. And I want you to plant a vegetable on the back of the donkey. And wait till it grows. Okay? And then what I want you to do is to take this donkey with a vegetable garden, plant it on his back. Now go into the main street. And do this for a few days in a row and then come back home." So he goes the first day, everyone's looking, "Whoa, what a crazy thing, a donkey that grows trees, you know, grows vegetables. Wow, to make a big commotion." Second day, a little less commotion. By the third day, "Oh, that's a donkey with the thing going, no commotion at all." He says, "That's going to be the same thing with you. You're going to come the first day, they're going to make a big deal. Big deal, there's a 40-year-old man with a bunch of 4-year-olds. But no, by the third day, they're not going to make a big deal about it anymore." All right? And therefore, he was able to started late, and we know Rabbi Akiva was the leader of his generation. He was the greatest of all the rabbis. Okay. And finally, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Elazar ben Azariah will come later on in this Haggadah. He's going to say, "Hare ani keven shivim shanim. I'm like 70 years old, and I haven't been able to prove my point regarding the saying of the Krishma." And the rabbis say, "What do you mean I'm like 70 years old?" Well, in the days of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, if you wanted to be the big leader of all the rabbis, it was unheard of for you to be a big rabbi before the age of 75. Until 75, you're like a punk. Like, you're not going to be elected to be the chief rabbi of all the Jews over there. Anyway, there was a whole thing going on over there. And there were great rabbis in that generation. But and there was a little bit of some technical issues. They weren't able to come up with a compromise candidate that everybody would be agreeable to. So they were thinking of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. But the problem was, Rabbi Elazar was only 18, with a black beard. And they wanted to appoint him to be the leader. And he turns to his wife, he says, they want me the leader. He says, they're not going to respect you. How could you be the leader? He went to sleep that night. The next day he woke up, his beard turned white. That's why he says, Hare ani kaben shivim shama. I'm like I'm 70 years old. That, again, that although he was young and not suitable to be the leader, but what? But you see, God can make the guy be the leader. So these five people, more so than any other rabbis of the Talmud, were the least likely to succeed in the Torah world. And they were the five of the greatest of the leaders of the generation. And where does that come from? This is what's inside the Jew. No matter how far we may be, inside is a tremendous soul that's yearning to grow. And it needs the right opportunities for this. So therefore it's these, because that's the theme of the night. The theme of the night is, no matter how low you are, you can rise to the top. That's happened in history on the night of Pesach, and it happens every year. Every year, if you listen more to the first part we gave this morning, we'll give many more examples of that. But that's the theme of the night. No matter how far, no matter how bad your year was, you wasted time, you didn't learn, you did avarice, all these things. But if you do the Seder properly and you beg Hashem, you look up to Hashem, and it's now is the time for the son to ask or the daughter to ask, you will never not believe what kind of transformation they put. Yeah, you had a question?
Yeah, just curious. Why Rabbi Elazar, why do they mention who his father is? He's the only one whose father they mentioned.
I don't know.
Just curious.
But,
unless he was
no, they didn't say Rabbi Akiva's father.
No, they only say Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah.
Oh, why didn't, I don't know.
It's the only one.
That's probably a good answer to it, but I don't know.
Unless he was someone.
Well, there were a lot of Rebbe Elazars. There was a Rebbe Elazar ben Aruch.
That's why.
There were a lot. Rebbe Eliezer, we always know as Rebbe Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. But Rebbe Elazar, there's a number of Rebbe Elazars. So we get to distinguish him from the others. Okay, let's move on now to the four sons. Four sons. Page 10, line 10. Baruch Hamokom, Baruch Hu, blessed is the one, blessed is God, blessed is he. Baruch Shenasan Torah Mesro, blessed is he who gave Torah to the Jewish people. Baruch Hu. Careful now. Keneged Arba Bonim Dibra Torah. The Torah speaks Keneged, opposite, four sons. Echad Chacham, one is a Chacham. Ve'echad Rasha, one is wicked. Ve'echad Tom, one is simple. And one doesn't know how to ask. So let's ask four questions just on this. We'll have our own Arba Kashas now. Our own four questions on this little piece over here. Number one, the grammar in Hebrew is not good. It shouldn't say Keneged Arba Bonim Dibra Torah. The Torah speaks against, as it were, opposite four. It should say Al. It should say Al Arba Bonim. The Torah speaks upon or on, about four sons. Number one. Number two, why do we call a child a she'eno yodeo lishol? He doesn't know how to ask. I don't know about you. Tell me what kid in the world doesn't ask questions? I mean, Kainara, I have many grandchildren. They all ask questions. You know, some are brighter than others. I'll admit some are less bright, even though they're my grandchildren. But they're all asking questions. So since when do you have a kid who's an Eino Yodeo Lishol? Okay. Number three, what's unusual, many things that we do in the Seder, why do we say, why do we take the car away? Why do we do this? Why do we do that? And what's the standard answer? Whenever they're going to ask you a question at your Seder this year, and they say, why do we do it? And you don't know the answer. This is the fallback answer. What's the fallback answer? So that the children should ask. Right. The Talmud says the Seder, for example, should be adorned with candies. Then in those days, they didn't have candies. They had almonds and nuts, which were expensive in those days. The table should be full with these things. Why? So the kids should ask. You should pique their interests. So the kids should ask. And there's a lot of things that so the kids should ask. We do things very strange. We move the car away at the beginning of the Seder. Now, it seems that so much focus is on the child that really doesn't exist. It's so much focus for the Ein Yod Elisha, the one who does not ask. Why don't we, you know, focus a little bit on the Chacham? Let's go through some. You notice it's not a very difficult Seder. The texts are very simple. There's no great halachic discussions. Almost like we ignore the Chacham. Right? It seems the main flow of the Seder is for the one who doesn't know to ask. Why? As well, why does it say, when it lists the four sons, it says, the Torah speaks against four sons. Echad, one is a Chacham. Echad, one is a Rasha. Echad, one is a Tam. Echad, so why don't we say it like this? Torah speaks of four sons. Chacham, Rasha, Tam, and Yisrael. What's this Echad business? Right? Those are good questions, eh? So one of the most beautiful answers that I've seen is that the truth of the matter is that the idea of the four sons is not really four different sons. It's really the four natures that are in people. And the truth of the matter is many of us exhibit all four natures at different times in our lives. Okay? And therefore, it doesn't say al arba banim. It doesn't say the Torah speaks about four sons. It speaks keneged arba banim. It speaks against the natures that could really be one son, but the four natures of people. And you could have one person can have all four of them. And really, it's interesting. The word for son is a ben, is a son. Banim. But there's also, bonim is very related to the word bonim, which means to build. And we have in the Gemara in Bracha, on a pasuk says, don't read it as bonayich, your sons, but read it bonayich, your builders. In other words, that a person is made of many, he's built with many different characteristics. And really, just like the world, we mentioned last week in the Parsha class, there's four different types of elements. We said inanimate objects, plant, living, and speakers. That's four different ways, right? That's the four basic elements in the higher order. Truth of the matter is, that's the nature of these four sons, or natures that we may have at times. The Chacham, the wise man, he's the guy who can speak. Intelligent speech. The wicked man, he's like the animal. The living being, he's like a behemoth. The simple son, he's like the plant. The plant, he's always just moving. He doesn't have a lot of questions. He moves from one thing to the other. Doesn't really dwell on any topics too much. And then the not one doesn't know to ask, that's the inanimate object. So he says, these four really, one person can have all those four. There are certain things in life, when you see them, your mind gets piqued, and then you really start talking a lot about it. You have so much to talk about. In areas that interest you, you could have people, you know, who say, you know, they can't come to a Gemara class. It's too hard. But, you know, when it comes to technological things, that guy could talk all day long and do all the hardest things in the world. You know why? Because his interest peaked in that area. He's a big chacham when it comes to techie things. And if he would really want to, he could be a big chacham when it comes to Gemara. But he's only a chacham in that area. The Rasha is the guy who's into the body. So, you know what? And that's the living being. And there are times a person just wants to get into that body. You know, you could be teching away for hours on hours. And then you're going to fress like a pig, eating three rib steaks. So you've changed from being a chacham in a silly world to become a behemoth in another world. Right? And then you can have the age where a person progresses. Person is developing himself. He's growing. He's building a business. He's like a plant. He's just moving. He's moving, running around. He's busy, this and that. But he really, it's all kind of simple. Doesn't really delve into any one area, go to any depth, like the simple son. And there's the one who doesn't know to ask. You know why? Because he's just so apathetic to those certain areas in life. That subject, you know, You get a guy who could talk all day long about sports, you know, all in on sports. Just say, what do you think about morality? Let's have a discussion of morality, ethics. And all of a sudden, the guy's got nothing to say. He's a stone. All of a sudden, he doesn't have anything intelligent to say. He could tell you what a cross check is and a body check, and he'll list every team and what the chances and the probabilities to make the Stanley Cup, and while this trade wasn't good, that trade wasn't good. He's mamish, a chochem, and that, he's amazing. But when you talk about something important, he's a doimim. And you know, people are apathetic about certain things, and everyone has something they're apathetic about. It's so difficult to change a person's nature. It's hard to change bad manners. Just like, imagine, take a rock and try to change a rock. You know, you can't change a rock. It's stuck in its place, right? There's nothing you can't move it, can't crack it. And the main job of the Seder night is focused to the one who in every other area in life is a big chacham. He's so clever, he can tell you all the politics in the Middle East. He mamash knows all the brilliant political analysis. And he can be a big Russia. He fresses on food when it's time to eat. And he's busy going from this thing to that, being a big macher and a knacker. But then when it comes to anything about spirituality, he's a stone. And the truth of the matter is, who's the one we got to affect more? It's the one who's a stone, the one who's apathetic, the one who's apathetic to his Yiddishkeit. Because the truth of the matter is, he could be a chacham. He could be a chacham if he wouldn't be so apathetic. And therefore, that's why we have to focus on that one. And that's why we're saying it's echad, 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 echad. It's all one guy. You know, one guy could be the four faces of one guy. And if you think about ourselves, how often do we, maybe if we look at different times of the day or times of the year, we become those kinds of people. And therefore, we want to focus mostly on the one who's just not interested, to bring the interest out to that person, to make him be part of what it's all about. Now, it's interesting, they tell a story of one of the great Hasidic Rebbes, the B'nai Yisachar. He had a custom that when he would, I guess before he started the Seder, because it couldn't be after he started the Seder, after he finished the Seder, he would go around the city and eavesdrop on the different Seders that were going on. To get a little hanah, to see how Yidden make Seders, you know. I guess when he was walking home from shul, because the Rebbe probably davened long, till he finished davening, everybody was home from shul and started his Seder. By the time he finished his Seder, it was probably like 5 o'clock in the morning, so probably before the Seders. So he passed by one house, and they're by the four sons. And he sees the head of the household. He's going like this. He's going, Echad! He's crying, Chacham! Echad! Russia! Going all four that way. And like he's crying. And every time when he says, Echad! Chacham! Like that. Pretty strange behavior. So the Rebbe figured, no, I think I'm going to pay him a little visit. Knocks on the door. He says, ooh, holy rabbi, what are you doing here? I just wanted to see your Seder. It sounded so beautiful from outside. I wanted to hear. She says, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting that the way you just did the four sons, I mean, where did you get this custom from? He said, I'll tell you the truth. My father taught this to me. My father taught me. He says, you know, every day when we say the Kriya Shema, it's a halacha. You say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokei Hashem, and the Shulchan Aruch says, you elongate the word Echad. Hashem Echad. It's supposed to elongate. That's halacha. You really should do that every single day. So my father taught me on the Seder, when you come to these Echads, you make the Echad just like you do Kriya Shema. And when the Rebbe heard this, he was so happy. He said, oh, this Yid took the four sons and turned it into a Kriya Shema. Now, that's a very cryptic statement. And later rabbis, as they, you know, it's a mitzvah to analyze Hasidic stories to know what the message of the story is. He says, you see what the Rebbe understood. And he was so happy. with this idea, and he explained it to his Hasidim, and then one Hasid another. So fellow finally explained what's going on. He says, you got to realize that especially on the Seder night, it's within the power of each person to overcome his natural tendencies and to overcome that and to become a much better person. How? By accepting the yoke of heaven. By accepting the yoke of heaven upon yourself, you can mamish change yourself. And that's why on the Seder night, even the Russia, even the Tom, even the Nishere Elisho, he can come to the recognition of Echad. It's not just the Chacham who says Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad and believes it. But not only the Chacham, but the Russia and the Tom and the Shein and the Elishol, they all can come to the level of Echad, that they can accept Hashem's yoke of heaven upon them. That's how far everybody can achieve. So when we come to a Seder, and you have certain family members come to your Seder, you might rather give up on everybody and say, no one cares on it. You cannot accept that. You have to believe there's a way to touch them. And you may not touch them the first year or the second year, but don't give in. Don't give in to the boorishness that you're surrounded. Don't give in to everybody who's saying, you know, let's just eat and get out of here. Deep down, if they're Jews, if they're not Jews, then that's another story. But if they are really authentic halachic Jews, and inside of them they have a holy, pure soul that needs to be touched. And there's so many different ways that it can be touched. Okay. Let's move on now to the next highlight of the story. And we move to another favorite, Vehi She'amda, on page 12. Now, there's a lot of beautiful renditions of Vehi She'amda. There's the old-fashioned one, Vehi She'amda, Vehi. And then you got the more modern, I think, Shweki version, Vehi She'amda, Lavoseinu Velanu. Anyway, but so the rabbis asked, so what's the main message in Vehi She'amda? Well, it's following the paragraph before that says that God kept his promise to Avram at the covenant between the parts. He said that we would be slaves and he would take us out, and that was a promise. And now we say, Vehi She'amda, and that promise has stood us well for us, Shelo Echad Bovad, not only one, Amar Aleinu Chalseinu, came to destroy us. Elisha b'chol dor v'dor, but of every generation. We don't have to go too far back. You just go to Washington, Tehran. You don't have to go far. Go to the UN. Omdim Aleinu Chalseinu, they stand up to destroy us. V'akodesh Baruch Hu matzileinu miyod. And Hashem saves us. So, let me just get the right place over here. So, the question is, would you say the song is a happy song or not? The tunes we use, they're pretty happy songs. They're more upbeat than the negative songs. It's not like Echa, you know. No. V'hi shamda, v'hi shamda, lavoseinu v'lanu, right? But now, let's look. Let's look. Most of this paragraph is a very depressing paragraph. Yeah, and every generation they want to destroy us. Like when you're saying these words, what you have to be thinking of, destruction of the two temples, the four exiles, the butchering that happened during the Crusades, Khmelnytsky, Spanish Inquisition. This is all part of the song. So, okay, the last line's not bad. Hashem saved us from them. Okay, so you got one good line in the whole paragraph. Is that enough to make us sing about it? I saw beautiful. This mom is beautiful. This is a beautiful answer. This is like, it goes right to it. It goes right to it. And this answer is given with a parable. There was a poor Jew who was living by his father-in-law and, you know, living by him, and wasn't making his own life. And then one day, the father, he was able to just make enough money to, his family gives him a little house somewhere, a little broken shack in the middle of a valley, face, real dump. And the guy starts to build it up a little bit, you know, there's a leaky roof, like a real garbage dump, and he fixes it up a little bit. And he makes it into a half-decent house, but nothing special. So he overcame that great challenge. But all of a sudden, one night, When he wants to go to sleep, all of a sudden, he hears some noise by the doors, and he realizes there's a ganef trying to break into his house. So he gets up, and he chases him away. Okay, well, so he's able to go back to sleep. But second night, same thing. Somebody's coming to rob him again. He gets up, he has to fight, and this and that, and he throws him up. And the third night, not only he realizes, his wife and kids realize someone's trying to burglarize them. And he has to get up, and he throws him out, and this and that. And he's wondering, I don't get it. This was a broken down shack. Even though I fixed it up, it still ain't a mansion by any stretch of the imagination. Why is everybody trying to rob me? So he says there must be only one solution. All these thieves are darn right sure that there's a buried treasure in this house. Because why would somebody rob a poor man unless they knew he had tremendous wealth? And so he would search. And then one day he found the millions that were taka hiding on the bottom of the thing. So says the Chazon Ish. He says there's 7 billion people. Oh, there weren't 7 billion in his day. But now, if he was alive today, there's 7 billion people on the planet. There's enough people to fight with in this world. And from all 7 billion people in the planet, they have to keep their whole attention on a small little country that has made, in his day, maybe it was 1 million people. Okay, now even with what? 6 million Jews there. With the Arabs and everything, whatever. 10 million people there. The whole, this little gornish of a country that's not even a dot on the map. 7 billion people are trying to discern. Why do they look at us so much like this? Why do they want to throw us out? Can only be one reason, because they realize there's a tremendous treasure in this Jewish people. And they want to take it all away from us. And that's why, when we read how we've been persecuted, he says there's only one explanation for all the persecution. Because we're darn right the best people in the world. Because only the ones who have the greatest treasures do people try to destroy and steal it from you. So therefore, that's a reason to be happy. You know, one time, Mutti Berger mentioned he was in a course in university, and there was a priest who was giving the class. And the priest said, you know, a lot of people have problems with the Holocaust and why God attacked the Jews and this and that. The priest said, my biggest problem with the Holocaust was the following. Why didn't Hitler want to kill all the Christians? Because as a Christian, you'd think he'd want to kill us. Because we represent morality and conscience, don't we? But Hitler, who was the greatest anti-moral person in the world, he says, the fact that he went and destroyed you, said the priest, that shakes my faith in my religion more than the Holocaust should shake your faith in your religion. Because he didn't want to destroy us. He should have wanted to destroy us. Because of everything that Jesus represented, of peace and love and brotherhood, why didn't he kill us? Because Hitler must have seen that there's nothing there. And only Judaism really had something worth destroying. Something that is so rich and powerful to change the world for the better, then obviously that has to be destroyed by evil people. But nobody's out to destroy Hollywood. Nobody's out to destroy any of the other Narishkeiten in the world, because they all know it's worthless. But they know if you destroy the Jews, then you've destroyed the greatest treasure in the world. And therefore we sing this song. We sing this song because we're proud. We're proud that they want to kill us. We're proud that they hate us. Because we know that's the biggest proof that we have the most powerful treasure in the world. And these people want to steal it from us. And therefore we have to, and therefore Hashem will protect us. Isn't that beautiful? That's beautiful. Right there. That's, yes, ma'am.
I just want to add to that.
Yes, ma'am.
That we have, we had a very, we had very close friends whose parents were Holocaust survivors, and the father in his, I think it must have been his last Seder that he was around, whenever, so during the whole Seder, he would keep reverting back to the Hisha Amda.
Yeah.
That was the whole, that his whole Seder was focused on that one particular point.
Right.
Because I think that's exactly what you're...
That's what it is.
That's what it
so,
is.
So like, you know, so... Yeah. So whenever I get an email from my good friend who always shows another blatant example of anti-Semitism, and I keep telling him, same old, same old, same old. Now we can both sing V'hisha Amda together and say, Baruch Hashem, there's anti-Semitism. Because when they're going to stop having anti-Semitism, that's the day they feel we don't have anything. So the more anti-Semitism... the more we sink, because we have what to sing about. Ah, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. All right, and now we fit. Now after that, there's another little story that leads into the next Dvar Torah, onto the next paragraph. There was a Jewish family who was living in America, they write. They were sitting at the Seder, and they were singing V'hisha Amda with great excitement. Okay. And, you know, in New York, I guess this was in New York with the apartments, and if you're singing a whole Seder in your apartment, the guy who lives next door is going to hear the noise, right? So the non-Jew goes into their house. A guy. They call him Mr. Jack. That's what they call this one. Jack. And he's listening to the tune. And Jack must have maybe knew a little Hebrew or something. I don't know. He looked in the English translation. He began to chop what the words were saying. He began to hear what V'hisha. Now imagine if a non-Jew is at the table and says, you know, God's protect us every generation to try to destroy us. He says, you know, Jew, why are you guys acting so foolishly? We live now in a democratic country. All the Jews are granted equality, fair rights, like any other non-Jew. Who's coming up against you to destroy you now? In America now, right? You're here, you live here, everything's fine, you're doing well, you're making good money, they're bankers and this and that. Yes, in the primitive times, yes, there were blood libels and ignorant Poles and this and that. But we live in an enlightened country. And we're not living in a world where dictators are killing people. America's not going to happen. You're free. And that's what the guy wonders. So what are you making a big deal about? And the answer is, if we continue the next paragraph in the Haggadah. Paragraph 12. Page 12, line 4. Say Lamad, go out and learn. My bikesh Lavan Arami lasus liyagavita. What did Lavan want to do to our father Jacob? Paro only decreed to kill the boys. For Lavan bikesh lakers the call. Lavan wanted to destroy us all. Shenemar, how do you know this? It says in the Torah when the Jew brought his bikurim offering on Shavuos, it said Arami oved avi, an Aramean, meaning Lavan, wanted to destroy my father. It says it explicitly in the Torah. He wanted to destroy my father. And then we went down to Egypt, etc., etc., etc. So what's going on? Look how it starts. It says, Tsei ulamad, go out and learn. Very, very unusual paragraph. No paragraph starts this way. It's just to say, Mabi Kesh Lavan, what did Lavan want to do to us? Why is this the story that's following up V'hisha Amda? Okay, it's segueing into all the verses we say when we bring the Bikurim, which becomes the outline of the Haggadah. But what's it say? Go out and learn. So the Torah is teaching us that there's a lot to learn when Yaakov went to Lavan. And if you would just do a superficial reading of the text from the time that Yaakov went into Lavan's house till he left him, you could be fooled. For example, when Yaakov first came to Lavan, and Lavan hears that Yaakov is coming, what's the first thing he does? He runs out to Yaakov, the Torah says, and he hugs him, and he kisses him, and he brings him to his house. He's the uncle. And he says, listen, you're my flesh, you're my bones, stay with me for the month. Friendly guy, hey? Right? Stay with me for a whole month. And then after a month, he says, because you're my nephew, you're going to work for me for free. Tell me what your wages are. Tell me what you want to get paid. Right. Want to give him a wage. And he's there the whole time. Then after 20 years, Yaakov runs away. And Laban catches up and says, why did you run away from me? Why did you steal my heart? Why didn't you tell me? If you would have told me I'd let you go away, I would have made a party for you and a parade and singing and dancing and a feast. You didn't give me a chance to kiss my children goodbye, my grandchildren goodbye. What's going on over here? He's such a nice guy, this Laban. He only has nice things to say about Yaakov, hugging him and kissing him and this and that, all these things. So the author of the Agoda says, Tse ulamad, go out and learn. Go beyond the superficial niceties and the diplomacy, but go deep and learn from Lavan Ha'arami, that uncle who spoke so nice and had such beautiful words to do. Say, what did he really want to do? Paro only wanted to kill the males, right? He only killed the males, but Lavan wanted to totally destroy the Jewish people, right? Because, and we'll see how in a minute, but that's what he wanted. So you know what? Don't be fooled by exterior appearances. And the question could be, well, wait a minute. If Yaakov already, you know, understood that craftiness is non-Jew, so why did he ever go down to Egypt? And the answer is, as well, you know, and even at that time, even if everything was good, Yosef HaTzadik was there, he was the viceroy, he ruled Egypt. And then how do all these, you know, terrible things happen afterwards? How can he put himself in Egypt in desperation? The answer is, as we learned, he had to. He had no choice. There was a hunger in the land. And therefore, Yaakov, as we go through the Haggadah, it says all this. It says that Yaakov went down against his will. And he said, I only went there to be a temporary resident, not to live there permanently. And that's what Yaakov told his children. As long as you live in the land of Goshen, a little bit separated from the Egypts, you know, you're going to be okay. That's why he sent Yehuda first to open up yeshivas in Goshen and to live in a Jewish ghetto, to be away from all the non-Jews. He understood that if we have to be in exile in Egypt, we have to be very careful what to do. And he said, if you want to really be sure, dwell alone and stay away from the non-Jews, because it's a great danger. Well, they welcomed us in Egypt with open arms. With open arms. And what happened after Yaakov died and his sons died and the tribes died, time passed. And what happens, people said, you know what? I think we got to be a little bit more modern. We got to be more with it. Be a little bit more Egyptian. Go to the theaters. Be up to date in everything. And then all of a sudden the Jews left Goshen and they filled all the populated areas of Egypt. And that's what the Medrash says. They went to the theaters and the circuses and this, and they became very good Egyptians. They got along with them. And then, of course, the tribe of Levi said, warning them, what are you doing? Don't do this. We can't be mixing with them. We have to be separate. We go back to the yeshivas. Remember what our grandfather Yaakov said. But no, we want to be more cultured. Let's be with the Egyptians. And then what happens? All of a sudden a new king gets up who didn't remember Yosef, didn't remember anything. And what does he do? He enslaved us biforech, avodas perach. Perach can mean backbreaking work. Perach also means a soft mouth. He sweet-talked us into slavery. He first asked all the good citizens of Egypt, please volunteer and help build our country. And the Jews volunteered to do it. And they did it such an amazing job. And then slowly, slowly, Paro began to cut the benefits. And then said, you know, I see how good you can work. Now you're going to have to do it if you have no choice or you're going to die. You think it only happened once? Hitler did it to the Jews. Same way. We're going to relocate you. And you guys are going to do us the big favor. You don't realize. You're going to bring all your wealth with you right now and we can just pick it up right at the door. And they were so friendly. The Germans were such nice people. Very cultured people. And everyone wanted to be friends with the Germans. And that's why the Germans knew they could do what they were going to do and the Jews couldn't stop them. They couldn't believe such a thing. People said they were lambs to the slaughter. They weren't lambs to the slaughter. They're no different than America never thinking a plane would ever go into the Twin Towers. Did you ever think you'd have to defend yourself against that? the Jews ever think that Germans, okay, we know, we're always in Gaulus. Okay, they'll send us to another place, fine. They really believe. Why shouldn't they believe? Why would they think? It never happened before. So they sweet-talked him into that. And that's what we have to say. And that was the answer to the fellow says, you live in a democracy. You live in a democracy. But the greatest danger to the Jew is when the non-Jew likes us. The Christian church, at least 30 years ago, finally got it. They understood burning Jews at the stakes doesn't work. They just get stronger. So instead, we're going to love them to death. We're going to accept them and love them and give them. And the more we give them, the more they love us. They're going to be part of us. And they'll self-destruct themselves. And that's how the entire people will be destroyed. And therefore, all the people who are so nice to us, that's so. Behold, Dor Vador. More Jews have spiritually been destroyed in the Holocaust in the United States in the last 70 years than were killed in the Holocaust. 6 million were killed in the Holocaust. The United States, after World War II, had 6 million Jews. By any simple math, there should be 12, 15, 18 million Jews in America. At least there's still 6 million Jews in America. What's going on? Because how many of them have assimilated and married out? How many of them have totally destroyed, but with a smile? And that's what we say. In every generation, they try to destroy us. Sometimes they want to destroy us by killing us. Then they want to love us to death. But it's the same goal. The goal is they want to destroy us. And therefore, because they know we have a precious treasure. Okay, now, we got 5 minutes. So we'll end with it. So we're going to come to the point we're going to eat the matzah. So I'm going to tell you a matzah story. An incredible story. Bergen-Belsen in 1944. I really need 15 minutes to say it. I only got five, so it's going to be the quick version. Anyway, we don't have to describe what it was to be in a concentration camp. And in this concentration camp was the Belzer Rebbe, the Blozhever Rebbe. The city of Blozhev, the Blozhever Rebbe. Anyway, he decided, a couple weeks before Pesach, he's already been in the camp for a while, he said, I'm making a decision, we're going to have matzahs this Pesach in Bergen-Belsen. And, of course, such a request is like suicide on many levels. You don't, the Germans would not allow you to practice religion, and you want to have matzahs, and you're publicizing this. I mean, you're a dead man. So what are you going to go? You're going to go to the head capo over there, whose name was, I have it written down here, and I can't find it now. Anyway, a bloodthirsty fellow, a terrible guy. And I even underlined his name. I'm trying to find him. Josef Kremer, the murderer. All right? The capo murderer. And he's like hated them. And you're going to ask him for permission? Like, you're going to be dead. He goes over and says, I have a request. What's that? We want to have matzahs all 8 days of Pesach. Imagine, you're going to get shot on the spot. The guy says, you know what? That's a very unusual request. I'll have to send a requisition to Berlin to see if they'll allow it. Psh, mamish, a nace. He went into the lion's mouth and didn't get killed. A couple days before Pesach, this Kramer comes in and says, you know what? Berlin said you could do it. Anyway, he says, okay, you'll go to the mess hall, tell us what you need. He says, listen, I need enough flour for 40 inmates to have matzah for 8 days. You just give us the flour instead of bread and we'll make matzah. Okay. Unbelievable. And they're baking the matzahs. It's unbelievable. And it's Erev Pesach. And they get all these matzahs. All of a sudden, Kramer comes in. All of a sudden, Jekyll and Hyde. He's saying, he gets so angry. He takes the blush of a Rebbe. He starts pounding him. He starts, mamish, beating him up. He says, you terrible people. What? How could you do this? Blah, 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 blah. And mamish. And then he goes to all the matzahs and breaks every single matzah and throws it into the mud. Everything they did was totally destroyed. And so what's going on? They finally found out that Berlin sent him word that there were some Jews who tried to escape. He said, we're so nice to you, and you tried to escape, you'll have no Passover Seder. And mamish, the Rebbe has been beaten to a pulp. Anyway, that night's the Seder night. So they managed to bring the Rebbe in. He's like, he's bleeding, is this. There was like one little piece of matzah left. So they're coming to the matzah. Now they got to decide who's going to be the one Jew to eat the matzah. So everyone thinks the Rebbe should get the matzah because he put his life on the neck. He's the holiest man. He's holding things. And they're about to give him the matzah. All of a sudden, a lady pipes up. It seems that in Bergen-Belsen, the men and ladies and kids all seem to be within a close distance. So this lady pipes up and said, he says, you know what? Tonight is the night of Igadat Labincha. You will tell it over your children. Now, the Rebbe was 55 years old at the time. He says, I have my little boy over here now. It can't be, I want him to know that even in Bergen-Belsen, you can eat matzahs. And I want him to be the one to eat the matzahs. And the Rebbe
said, the lady.
And the Rebbe agreed. And the boy was the only one who ate the matzahs. Anyway, the war finally ended. The Rebbe survived. The lady survived. A year or two later, the lady, she's an almana, her husband got killed. She goes to the Rebbe and says, you know, some people have proposed a shidduch for me. And Rebbe, I'd like you to know if you think, maybe you know who this guy is. What's his name? Yisrael Shapiro. Now, by the way, she didn't know that, but that's the name of the Blazer for Rebbe. This is called the Blazer for Rebbe. You think you know his name?
Right.
Says, you know what? Maybe you should try that shidduch. And then it's him. And they got married. And he raised this little boy as his son. And people said, you know, what kind of prophecy was this? That you ended up giving a matzah to someone who would be your son. And how did this, were you a prophet? He said, I was not a prophet. But I saw such emuna in this woman. Where all you saw around you was death. Nobody knew what would happen even the next morning. Even one second you weren't sure about your life. And in these situations, this woman, she thinks about one thing. The future of the Jewish people. That her son should know that in Bergen-Belsen you can eat matzah. For that emuna, he said, such a woman who gave the matzah to her son, it was befitting that I should fulfill the mitzvah, you shall teach it to your son. And that's the message you have to believe when you eat that matzah. You have to realize it's the future. If we don't have an eye for the future, then there's no point in the present. Okay, I still didn't finish everything. So it's going to be a part 3 somewhere.